Saca, please. Hello and welcome to the Point Blank Show. My name is Abhishek and our guest today is Gregory Zuckerman, who writes about business and finance. He's authored several books. Today we are going to talk about his New York Times bestseller, The Man Who Solved the Market, How Jim Simons Launched the Quant Revolution. Since 1988, one of the funds operated by Mr. Simons, a genius of a mathematician, has generated average annual returns of 66%. And all this using numbers, data, analytics, and machine learning long before they became sexy. His outsized profits put him in a different league. And even Warren Buffett, George Soros, and Peter Lynch can't boast or don't boast of such a record. Thanks a lot, Gregory, for joining in.
Sure, glad to be here. Happy to see you.
Thank you. You've written a bunch of books, and there seems to be a bit of a pattern in them. You wrote about the greatest trade ever, which I quite enjoyed reading. It was about one man who made $20 billion. We hadn't read about in the papers as much as a few others. Then you have, which I'm still reading, A Shot to Save the World, about scientists who came up with this brilliant vaccine just in time to save the world. And then we have The Man Who Saved the Market, How Jim Simons Launched the Quant Revolution. Now, how do you pick your subjects? And when you read about them, the first feeling, at least I got, was, how didn't I know about these folks beforehand? And why are they not household names?
Sure. So I work at the Wall Street Journal. I've been at the Wall Street Journal since 1996. So I'm business oriented. I write other things once in a while, but mostly business, finance. I like how people make money, lose money. I'm a sports guy, so I often write about strikeouts and home runs, baseball, to use baseball metaphors. Home runs and strikeouts, big successes and big failures, because there are lessons to be learned, because there's a lot of drama, both at the Journal but in my book writing as well. What I really love to do is unpack, uncover the behind the scenes, what really happened behind something big, something historic, something remarkable, some accomplishment. And I also like there to be a paradox. In all my writing, I've written 4 books for adults. I've written 2 for young people with my 2 sons, actually. And in all my writing, there's some paradox. It should not have been these people who accomplished something big. So you'd mentioned the COVID vaccine book I wrote, A Shot to Save the World. Who should have saved us all? It should have been a big vaccine company. It should have been Merck. It should have been GSK. And it wasn't. And I tell you the story of the people behind them who really pulled it off. And then what lessons we can learn from these unlikely heroes. And the same thing with The Man Who Solved the Market. Who should have produced the best record, the best firm, the best hedge fund in history, should have been some people that actually really care about finance, care about investing, care about companies. I grew up really being interested in companies and how they work and how they operate. The people at Jim Simons' firm, Renaissance Technologies, they don't really care. They're not really investors. They don't care about business so much. And yet they're the ones. How did that happen? So I always set out with some big question like that.
And I'm tempted to ask you how much secondhand smoke did you ingest while interviewing Simons, who you make a reference in your book. It was like walking into an ashtray, says one of the characters in your book, when they meet Simons.
Yeah, so this character, Jim Simons, is a character. He's a mathematician, a scientist, an investor, a philanthropist, but he's also a smoker. He's a chain smoker, and he always has been. And you would say to yourself, well, geez, he's so brilliant. Why is he pushing the odds there? But he's beating the odds. And I think at some point he realized, I mean, I guess. I think I write about it in the book briefly. He came to some calculation. He was 50 or so and healthy and realized that he was the exception. Like in every rule, there's an exception to the rule. So he's the exception to the rule. So he chain smokes. And he also is a billionaire. He's worth whatever, 20-something billion, 27 billion. So he can get away with things that other people can't, such as smoking indoors, smoking in a restaurant, smoking whenever he wants to. No one can get away with that, at least in the United States, but he can. So yeah, so I had to ingest a lot of smoke to write this book.
And talking about exceptions, how difficult was it to approach a book where the subject is a genius of a mathematician. His colleagues are all PhDs. They've won medals. Even if they hadn't, some of them hadn't invested, perhaps they would have merited a book. What did you do, let's say, when you got your publisher's advance, when they said, hey, here's the money, you've got to write the book? What was it like for you?
So it was stressful because they're the most secretive firm in Wall Street history. So I wasn't surprised that the publisher was excited, but even when I was getting good information about the early days at Renaissance and I knew I could write something good about that period, I was still stressed out about whether I could get any information about what's going on today. Why would people talk to me? I wouldn't talk to me. What's the purpose? What's the upside? There's only downside. They're already wealthy, these people. They don't want to be famous. They're secretive. So I was stressed out. Yeah, it was a difficult book. It was also math-oriented. Not to say that you need some level of understanding of math to read the book, but the point is I had to have some level of understanding of what they were doing. And it's high-level stuff, and I'm not a math person, so I had to really understand that. I hired tutors and stuff and had to relearn things and learn things for the first time so that I could explain it in simple ways for the reader. So it was a difficult book to write. I remember passing it in and just telling my wife, I'm done. I can't write any more books. I'm shot. And then I, ironically enough, wrote a book about the shot. So that went away. But yeah, it was a hard book to write.
Let's talk about the approach of Simons in terms of investing as opposed to the time-honored technique of what we were taught, let's say, or generally how the kind of noise that our financial advisors in India also make is that your investment should be rational. Don't invest in something that you don't believe in. And I think that's what Warren Buffett apparently said long ago. You write in your book that Peter Lynch, his most important tool was his phone and not his computer, where he would pick up the phone, talk to people, network, find out what's happening. Whereas I was quite amazed, Simons and his ilk, they didn't really care about companies and fundamentals. So what was his approach towards investing in layman's terms?
Yeah, so Jim Simons and his firm, Renaissance Technologies, they're very revolutionary. And in some ways, people have copied what they're doing, and more people now, at least, have embraced their approach than the traditional approach. People are going away from that traditional approach that you and I like this toothpaste, so hey, we have some insight into the toothpaste and we like this brand, so look into the stock and you've got some advantage. Markets are just so much more efficient than they used to be. So for the average person to try to feel like he or she can outsmart, have some edge, it's just harder than it used to be. It's not to say that it can't happen. Let's say you're a doctor and there's a new medical device and you really are a believer, you've seen it work and other people don't know about it or are skeptical. Yeah, you've got some little edge there, but forget about the average person, even the average mutual fund manager. What do they have? What edge do they have? And it's worse than that. We've all learned that there are behavioral mistakes. Behavioral economics is a whole field. There are things that we all do to undercut our chances of success. And Jim Simons and his colleagues sensed all this decades and decades ago. They were just revolutionaries in so many ways. They were developing AI. They were doing artificial intelligence in the 1980s. They were handing over the decisions of their firm, their hedge fund, to their computers, to their models, to their systems decades ago. They were creating predictive algorithms before Netflix, before Facebook, before all that kind of stuff. So their approach was, well, first of all, they're mathematicians and they're scientists. And they said to themselves, this is Jim Simons really saying, there's probably some patterns out there in the market that keep appearing and repeat. And we're going to try to find those patterns. And that's what they set out to do, using mathematics. And on the one hand, you say, well, geez, how do these people that really don't know much about companies, they don't have interest in business? And I write about in the book about how at one point they said that they shouldn't even have names for companies for stocks. They should have numbers. And people get carried away with getting putting their heart into the companies and believing in a company and a name and such. And it's better to take a standoff approach and hands off and not have emotion involved. But they said to themselves, okay, what are our advantages? Our advantages are looking, seeking and discovering patterns that the naked eye can't perceive. So that was their approach, right. and it's work. It's not for everyone, but it's a quantitative approach, is being a quant. And now a lot of Wall Street, a lot of finance is quantitative. Everybody's got their PhDs. Everybody's got their quants. And listen, I don't think everybody needs to be a quant, but I do believe in that approach and that systematized approach, as opposed to kind of winging it and using your instinct and your intuition. It's just not as reliable as you would think.
Right. And in the book, you draw an analogy with, I think, poker players, where you write that mood of an opponent may determine your move. So you don't need to know why the other guy is miserable or happy before he plays the move, as long as you know what the move is. So in parallel, you don't care why, as long as a mathematical model tells you that there is some money to be made here, these guys would bet on it. I think there was a joke, right, where you make somewhere that one of the key lieutenants of Simons talks about Chrysler as a company when it wasn't even listed on the stock exchange. For him, it didn't matter, like you said. It didn't matter what the name of the company was, what the fundamentals were, as long as the numbers dictated whether or not they should bet.
Yeah, Bob Mercer, who was the co-CEO for a while at the firm, was once in a meeting with some outside investors who were thinking about writing a big check and investing in the firm, Renaissance Technologies. And I write about it in the book, how he used Chrysler as an example across the table in some big presentation. And all his colleagues started getting worried and upset. And Bob, they didn't say this, but they were thinking, Bob, there's no company Chrysler. There's no stock anymore Chrysler. It was acquired.
Right.
But it underscores the point. They didn't really care. They're mathematicians and scientists, and they're looking for things that you and I aren't, and it works for them. And I think there are good reasons why it works for them. That approach is a smart one.
And I quote one more line from your book about the investing approach. You say he was accustomed to scrutinizing large data sets and detecting order while others saw randomness. Can you illustrate this with an example as to when people didn't know something was brewing? And he said, okay, let's invest here.
So that's the thing. Renaissance and Jim Simons, they never make any one bet, any one wager on a particular industry or stock per se. It's all about relationships, often among groups of stocks. And they look at historic, but it's more than just saying, okay, historically, these relationships, they traded this way, then now they're trading another way, they're going to come back together. They look for anything that could affect prices. They'll test anything, any kind of data set. If you've thought about a data set, they've purchased it. I don't know, shipping in Singapore, how many people are docking and what time of day, and does that impact a certain industry? Does that impact the overall market? That impact a certain Asian market? That's what they do. They've got groups of people at Renaissance just buying and testing data all day long. Anything, weather patterns, news oriented. So that's kind of obvious. Anything crazy, and any possible impact on markets for whatever reason. And as you had suggested earlier, they don't care as much about the why. As long as it's mathematically sound and valid, it happens repeatedly, then they'll bet on it. Now, it's not to say that they're not curious about the why, and they do look into it afterwards, and they'll increase their bet if they can figure out why a phenomenon is happening. But in general, unlike you and I, they don't really care as much about the why. It's a whole different approach to investing, and it's not a particular stock. They're not ever long the market or short the market or any industry kind of thing. Yeah. It's groups of stocks, groups of relationships. They often do really, really well in panics when everyone's kind of selling and buying or buying in mass. They do really well in those kind of environments. And partly it's because their data is better than everybody else. They have data going back centuries we're talking, and it's valid, it's accurate data. They were cleaning it before anybody else, before that was even a concept. They were checking out, making sure their data was accurate. And it's not as easy as you would think. Sometimes they would buy things going back decades and decades or centuries. Let's say gold or silver prices going back centuries, and there were weird anomalies or looked like anomalies and aberrations. And they would look into, okay, on that day, was there a snowstorm and someone forgot to update the numbers because no one was in that day? And and it looks like the prices were up or down or just looked weird, but turns out someone inputted it wrong. They would go, and it's painstaking work, and it's boring work, it can be work, and it takes a long time, but they would put that work into cleaning their data. So their data was such an advantage, not as much anymore. Now people have better access to data, but they've got data. So in other words, something happens today in the market. I don't know, you think it's unusual, it's new, some attack, some war, some environmental calamity, but there's some parallel to that, generally speaking, in history, and they can find that parallel, and they can see how many days the market was down that day or up. How did people react? And you know, human behavior isn't so dissimilar going back decades, so or even centuries. So they'll make some analysis of that and some deduction from that and into what's going to happen going forward. It's better data than everybody else, and that's really helped them.
Right. Today, we take this for granted, where we have online portals from where we can buy data. And I think I read they had some magnetic tapes in which they would collect the data and store them, or they had something around cotton prices, was it, going back to the World War II. And then there was a secretary back in the day who would stand up on the stool to write down painstakingly on the wall all these figures.
That was the early days. Yeah. That was like the 1980s. So that doesn't happen anymore. But yeah, they were doing the hard work. They were quants before there were quants. They were AI developers before there was AI. They were machine learning. They were specialists. They were algorithmic traders. They were developing predictive algorithms. They were doing all kinds of stuff. They were pioneers in so many ways that's really not appreciated. And I mean, listen, going back even decades earlier, Jim Simons was breaking code, is building algorithms in the Cold War, going up against the Russians, working for the U.S. government. So he's really, in so many different ways, such a pioneer.
Yeah. And despite for all the firepower that they have of data analytics and tools and PhDs, it's still, they make money on around 50-51% of all their trades, which also means that it's not that easy. So it's not like today, if I were given all the best minds in the world, I'm not guaranteed to make money. So it's a very risky business despite all of this then.
Yeah, it's a good point. On the one hand, people say to me, well, Greg, geez, look how much money they've made. It must show the market is really inefficient and there are a lot of opportunities out there. And I kind of say, well, that's the case. But in some ways, they're the exception that proves the rule, because even they, like you say, they get it right about 51% of their trades. A little bit like a casino, you know, a casino doesn't get it right all the time, just a little bit more than 50%, but they do a lot of trading, or they're on the other side of a lot of trading or betting. And the same kind of thing with Renaissance, they do a lot of trades. They're always making moves. Their holding period is very short. So you and I can't really do what they do. Their holding period is, they say, seconds to seasons or moments to months, but it's generally, I think, around two days on average, but it could be much shorter than that. And they don't get it right all the time, but they are a consistent money maker. And as a result, they can get a lot of leverage. They borrow a lot of money from Wall Street because their returns are so consistently good. So it's a great approach. You borrow a lot of money, you make a lot of bets, you make small amounts on a lot of different trades, and it just adds up to a lot of victories, a lot of profit.
And the people behind all of this, you also write about how eccentric they are. And one of the interesting bits from the book also is about Simon's management style. He needs to figure out how to get the best from his troops, and all of them are super intelligent. How did he go about that?
Yeah, it's funny. After I wrote the book and when I started talking about it, I realized that the book, yes, it's a book about quantitative trading, it's about investing, but it's really a management book in a lot of ways, or book about human nature. Because Jim Simons, some people will say, well, Greg, the book is called The Man Who Solved the Market, but why is only half the book about Jim Simons? And it is true, it's because he he was really great at recruiting and hiring and finding a talent and getting them to go work for his firm. And there are a lot of lessons there. That's the beauty. That's the genius of Jim Simons. He's not just a quant. There are very few people who I've ever experienced and encountered like him. He can do all the quant stuff. He's a historic mathematician. He's a geometer. He goes down in history as one of the greatest mathematicians of the last century or two. But he's also someone who understands human nature and can have a drink with you and make you laugh and understand you and talk to you. And there are very, very few people in that world like that, who are good managers and recruiters, but also can do the math and build the algorithms. It's really rare. And that to me is the secret. People always are like, well, what's the secret here, Greg? I want to trade like Jim Simons and I want to make billions. It's not a how-to book, but and part of it is just it's hard to get both those kinds of skills. And yeah, he was really great at identifying talent and then recruiting talent. And we're talking going back to before Renaissance, when he ran a math department at Stony Brook University in New York, and he honed some of those skills. That's why I go back in history, because you can learn from how they developed those talents. And he was really just really good at finding what motivates people. And that's so important. Everybody's different. Everybody's motivated by a different thing. And it's hard to understand motivations. I don't even understand my own motivations, let alone someone else's. And my gosh. And Jim's good at, he's great at that. So in other words, he'd say, he'd realize some people just like solving problems. Some people want to get rich. Some people want a challenge. These are mathematicians. These are scientists. Some people just like to work with others. Some people are motivated by trying to impress their colleagues. And these are some of the top people in the fields in the world. Some people just want to change. He would say, hey, come on over, spend the summer with us. You don't have to commit. Come spend the summer. Come give a lecture. Come check it out. Some people just like being in Stony Brook. It's by the water. It's pretty over there. There are all kinds of ways that he would motivate people and entice people and lure people and woo people. And it's a whole different skill set. It's hard to teach that kind of thing too. So he had it both, which is rare quality. And listen, he's not some hero. I don't write these books, put these people on a pedestal. He's got faults, but he's pretty impressive guy.
I think you talk about how he worried that his best minds might slack. So he had to come up with a project to keep them interested and creative. And he launched a new fund in that guise. And also, what do you attribute this to when there is a panic or when certain decisions have to be taken? Now, all of them are equally intelligent, let's say, at that level. And one of them tells Simons that, hey, we are some 300 million losses. We are staring at them. And at that time, he says, you know, trust the model. We have to let it ride. We can't panic. I also quote from The Greatest Trade Ever, where there is a section of the book, and of course you've written this way back in the day, just humor me. And here it says that there's one colleague walks into Paulson's office and he says, hey, we need to do something. We need to sell this. And he says, no, keep buying, Brad. That's what he says. So how is it that they keep their cool under pressure when others around them are losing their wits?
It's a good question. It's a rare skill. There aren't many people who are able to pull it off. I mean, I would argue that I don't think it's anything you can teach. It's something, hey, listen, it helps that you've got super smart colleagues. And then there are people that lead the organizations, and there always were people, either Simons or others, who make the final decisions. So it's difficult. So even the billionaires that I deal with, you'd be surprised. They're up in the middle of the night, worried about their portfolios. I'm thinking about one guy in particular who I'm writing about for a new book, and he's worth billions. And yet, it's like canceling meetings with me because he's, Greg, I'm underperforming. I'm miserable. I'm not in a good mood. I can't really talk right now. You'd be surprised. They're human like everybody else. One of my favorite parts of the book, the Simons book, The Man Who Solved the Market, is after he's kind of stepped back from Renaissance and he's got his own portfolio and there was a panic in the market, and he calls his broker and says, should we be buying some puts here? Should we be getting some protection? When he told me that, I was like, Jim, you're a quant. You're the preeminent quant. You're the pioneer. And you're like anybody else looking at CNBC and saying, oh my gosh, what should I do? Call my broker. It shows after decades of groundbreaking work, you're still like everybody else. He didn't really appreciate that so much, but yeah, these guys are human and these women are human. They're like everybody else. They panic and they get nervous. And that's why it is important to have a system and try to let the model decide, or at least have some systematized approach. In other words, even like a pilot nowadays, when they get in, they've got like a checklist, or a surgeon has a checklist. We should all have something like that in our lives, or something we can rely on, because there are all kinds of reasons why we let our emotions dictate our decisions, and it doesn't usually work out so well.
So do you see that computer-generated models in the future is what will run everything, and are they more efficient as compared to the George Soros or Warren Buffett way of investing, where you don't worry about anything, let the machines decide, because they know they because finally human beings will not change the way they act unless there is a GameStop-like exception that comes along, perhaps?
Yeah, so I do think that the quantitative or systematized approach is a better approach, except that here and there, the exceptions, you have some insight into a particular product or industry that maybe the masses don't know, that the others don't know. You're a doctor with a medical device, that kind of thing. Otherwise, it's hard to beat the market. I've been writing about these guys forever. So that gentleman in my first book, John Paulson, he made the greatest trade ever. He made $20 billion over two years, 2007 and 2008, anticipating the financial crisis. And he came up with, it wasn't just that he anticipated it, he figured out the perfect way to profit from it. But then his returns subsequently were really bad. Not awful, but just underperformed. And it wasn't because he was any less smart. He didn't get dumber overnight. He just started doing things he didn't do until then. He got away from what got him so rich and famous. And that's the temptation. You have like a lot of people around you, and trust me, I deal with them all the time. They only tell you how great you are and how smart you are and how brilliant you are. You only have yes men around you. And as a result, you start doing other kinds of things. That's the temptation. So John Paulson is just as smart today as he ever was. But he started saying, well, geez, I'm going to start investing in pharmaceutical stocks and buying gold. Those kind of things made that trade so remarkable. It's still a remarkable trade. It's still one we could all learn from. But and I write about it at the end of the book, people start getting a little carried away and they think they can manage more money, et cetera. There are a lot of temptations and emotions when it comes to investing.
Another thing I learned, that it's never too late to get started. Simons was well in his 40s, wasn't he, when he started, or maybe he was 40 odd, and in his fourth career of sorts, and then it started to pick up. So it's never too late, even if you're a late bloomer, then, in whatever it is that one is doing.
In all my books, it's weird. All my books, the huge accomplishments come later in life, after 40, after 50. It happens over and over again. Oh, yeah, it's never. If anything, maybe you're better suited in a lot of different ways. Older, you've got more experience to lean on, better judgment, perhaps.
Last couple of questions, and I take you to your experience of writing the book. And I've, in the acknowledgement section, you pay a tribute to your dad in that he's someone from whom you've learned a thing or two about writing. So I was curious to know, what are the top three things that your father advised you, that this is how your prose should be, or text should be? I'd be very interested.
Thank you for asking about him. I don't think anybody ever has in my interview, so I appreciate that. My father passed away in 2009 at too young an age, but he was a professor. He was an academic. He wrote about political science and Judaic history. And he was a good writer. He was a really good writer. And what I learned a lot from him was, he used to take my writing and just cut words, write through them, cross them out, and pare down the writing and just to the essence. And I think that's a great trait as a writer. I tried to remember that. You don't want to go on and on. You don't want it to be flabby, the writing. It should be pared down and to the point. And I try to do that. I'm not sure I always succeed, but that's one lesson I learned from him. And he was a funny guy. He had a lot of humor in his life. And I try to bring a little humor to my writing. There's always interesting ways and funny ways to look at every circumstance. And, you know, life's short. So if you're going to pay whatever it is to buy one of my books, you should enjoy it. It shouldn't just be something you learn from and is entertaining. It should be enjoyed. You should come away with smiling as well. But I don't care what the topic is. I write about kind of dense, potentially dense topics, science and algorithms and quantitative finance and credit default swaps. But these are people. These are human people. So there's humor involved. There's always going to be ways to look at it. And my father was a funny guy. So I guess that's another lesson from my father. And he was also somebody who could find interest. He was interested in anyone. And I remember that lesson as well. So it could be he taught at an Ivy League university, but he wasn't snobby. He would talk to anybody and find anybody interesting, and he could learn from anybody at our like local synagogue. You know, there are people that just aren't doing as well in life, etc. But they're super smart too, and they've got interesting opinions, and you can learn from anybody. I don't care who it is. So Jim Simons, all the way on down, and you can learn from every. You should learn from. I think anyway. I try to. That's one of the lessons.
Lovely. Thank you, Gregory, for this book, for your time on this podcast. I know you have to run to the next appointment that you have, but thanks a lot for giving out those little nuggets in the end. Because I too am curious about, you know, when you talk to folks, what are the things that you need to ask? For example, whether it's a truck driver, if you're reporting for a story here in India, or folks like you. I think one of the tenets is that one should not be too condescending, or should not be condescending when you write. So none of your writing is talked down to. So it's in a way which is understandable by everyone and in a language that is easy as well. So thanks for that.
Thank you. Thank you for noticing. Yeah, I'm a big believer that everyone has a story. I know everyone has a story. I go to a barbecue and you sit down next to a dentist, whatever. You say to yourself, all right, just another dentist. No, he or she has overcome something in their lives, in their personal lives. Health or children or something. There's something you can learn from them. There's an older person there. They've seen so much. You can learn from it. I try to learn from everyone. Everyone's got a good story and an arc to their lives that we can all learn from. So yeah, I hope to keep doing that. And I invite your listeners to reach out. I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. So feel free to reach out, email too.
Lovely. And all the very best with all the research for your next book, whatever it is that you're on.
Thank you. Stay well, everybody.